In 2014, President Obama used his executive powers to try to protect 5 million immigrants. And here's what you said at the time.
Right.
This is wrong, it's irresponsible, and will do damage to our efforts to fix a broken immigration system. This is a tremendous presidential overreach.
So why was that an overreach for President Obama then, but not for President Trump now?
Well, what President Obama did, he didn't declare a national emergency about the DACA recipients. He took his power to pardon an individual or a small group and applied it to 1.8 million people. Every president, not every, a lot of presidents have declared emergencies. After 9/11, we did, and they've taken money and powers to deal with a national emergency. I think there is a crisis at the border. I think it fits the definition of a national emergency. It's the last option, not the first option, but we're pretty close to that being the only option.
That was Senator Lindsey Graham speaking Sunday with Fox News's Chris Wallace. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast, which is available at all your finest podcast vendors and over at Reason.com, which you should be hitting on a daily or hourly basis as well. I am Matt Welch, joined per usual on this frigid East Coast Monday by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Y'all holding up?
Little chilly.
Yeah. I love it.
The best parts about snow days in Washington, D.C. is that Catherine always says on the Reason Slack, remember, the Reason policy on snow days is that your adults act as you will. I just want to point that out there.
Does that explain the problems for the 363 days of the year when it's not a snow day in the office?
Yes, succinctly.
Our dress code, by the way, is also please wear clothes.
So restrictive. What a
inappropriate.
Too bad Robbie Suave didn't get that memo. All right, let's get to it. Catherine.
Hi.
Does Lindsey Graham have a point? Is there a intellectual policy defense for supporting President Trump using national emergency as a quote unquote last resort in a legislative negotiation in order to get more walling built on the border? If you have, like Lindsey Graham has, opposed on grounds of bypassing Congress, President Obama's attempted expansion of DACA back in 2014.
So I think it is important to try to do things legally. And, I think the distinction that Graham is trying to make is, okay, the technically legal loophole that Obama used is somehow bad, and the technically legal loophole that Trump is going to use is somehow fine. I think, in fact, in both cases, the real question is, well, is the resulting policy good? And I obviously think in the case of the wall, it wouldn't be. But I am weirdly reassured, I guess, that in both cases, they did seek a sort of the most robust legal rationale for what they wanted to do. All things being equal, Congress and the courts would then say, like, good try, but you didn't quite make it, friends.
But, I mean, so wait, you're saying that, like, if your heart's in the right place, it's okay to...
No, I'm saying the opposite of that. I'm saying that it is good that in both of these cases, the president didn't just say, listen, I want to do it, I'm going to do it. They said, okay, here is the statute, here's the way, here's the exact technicality I'm going to employ. Still, it is up to the other branches of government to vet whether or not that justification is adequate. But I think it is important to distinguish between that and what I think people are hysterically implying about Trump, which is that he's just doing whatever he wants. He's basically a tyrant now. Like, there are provisions for the president to declare a state of emergency and do certain things in that case, and he's going to try them.
I am a little skeptical of this.
Yeah, go ahead.
So let's start with the difference between what Obama did and what Trump seems likely to do, what Graham wants him to do. Mm-hmm. What Obama did was stretch the limits of existing presidential authority to prioritize certain types of prosecutions. Basically, I mean, like, so Graham described it as using the pardon power, but it's really about sort of saying here are our law enforcement priorities. That is something that has to be done. You always have to prioritize. You cannot go after every jaywalker, every $2 pot deal. It's just not a possibility. And so this is in terms of going after going after illegal immigrants, there is a question of how big a priority is that, and in which cases are we going to make a priority? The president made a decision. It was a big one. I agree it was a stretch of his authority, but it was arguably within his existing authority. What Trump is doing is to declare a national emergency, which gives presidents with some guardrails, a kind of unbounded, beyond the normal executive authority power. And that is why people are worried about it. It's not like, yes, it is legal. Presidents do have the legal authority. But what you're basically saying is when you say that it's okay, or even that like there's something good about like make the fact that it is a legal option. Yes, it is legal for presidents to do a whole bunch of crazy worrying stuff if they declare a state of emergency. And that's what Trump is doing here. And I think that this is while I would say that I can understand people who were concerned about the DACA stuff, I think those concerns are legitimate to some extent. This seems much more worrying to me. And it really seems like a kind of legal justification that has been built on the back end to fit the fact that Trump wants this thing, rather than we're going to like this. There is a national emergency that is really happening and we need to figure out a solution. And this is the best one. If you listen to that clip beyond what we played, the next thing that Lindsey Graham says basically is, well, you can't negotiate with Nancy Pelosi when she says that even if we reopen the government, I'm not going to build a wall. Trump wants a wall. A wall that is stupid, a wall that won't work, a wall that even immigration restrictionists, you guys like Mark Krikorian, will say is basically a symbolic policy that's not even really a priority, won't be effective. Trump wants that, and so he is declaring a state of national emergency. He is threatening to declare a state of national emergency, being encouraged to do so by Lindsey Graham in order to get a pointless symbolic campaign promise.
See, I feel you on this. I mean, believe me, I liked the outcome of Obama better than I would like the outcome of Trump here in this immigration case. But I still think both are essentially post facto rationalizations for political decisions. Both are essentially symbolic acts. I mean, even in the case of Obama's stuff, you know, it did impact arguably more people, but it was still not it did not really change the underlying dynamics of our immigration system in this country. And I think in both cases, it was, you know, there's a cover of this is just ordinary prioritization in the case of Obama, but it wasn't. I mean, that was.
I didn't say it was ordinary. I said he pushed the limits. Right. I agree that that's what he did. And I think that it is reasonable. While I think that one is more justifiable, I think that it is reasonable to be concerned
about. But also, Lindsey Graham is right that states of emergency are normal. I mean, I don't like that. I don't think that's good. But in fact, many, many presidents have done that, including Obama. They do it all the time. Lindsey Graham is right. That sentence hurts my heart. It does. But like, it's that the phrase sounds more dramatic than it is. In fact, we are basically always in like 30 or 40
states
of emergency.
Before Nick jumps in, I just wanted to throw out the factuals on DACA and DAPA. The 2014 thing referenced at the top was the expansion of the Deferred Action Program for it stands for the kids, the Dreamers, the expansion from the several hundred thousand who were affected by that to cover their parents, which would have been the estimate, I think, is 3.7 million people, it's a program. President Obama was going to create a new program that didn't exist, and it's a program that was never authorized by Congress. That was blocked successfully at the courts through injunctions, and I think it went up to a 4-4 stalemate at the Supreme Court. So the amicus brief that Lindsey Graham filed was read and listened to, and it had some effect. DACA stayed into effect, and now it's kind of in this limbo thing.
Say, you know, the upside of all of this is that Lindsey Graham's slow but steady transformation into Jar Jar Binks, Senator Jar Jar Binks, is almost complete, because he is now demanding that the Republic give over emergency kind of dictator powers to Lord Palpatine. So, you know, there's that. I mean, at least we're moving forward on that important score. I think that it is, you know, I think the points that Peter and Catherine are arguing are all important, you know, and what we're talking about here is still rule of law in the sense that all of these actions are being claimed with, you know, using some procedures that are in place, whether it's a proper application or not. This is not Andrew Jackson telling the Supreme Court to go fuck itself in enforcing its, you know, the decision that the Cherokee Nation doesn't actually have to be, you know, that they win in the Supreme Court and they don't have to move. He just forcibly removed them. It's we're not quite there yet. But I do think it's really important in these kinds of cases to look at the, you know, the basic realities and the claims that are being made, because there is no question that Donald Trump wants a wall. He's, you know, he won't stop talking about it. But the facts that he is marshaling in defense of the idea of a crisis and a national emergency are patently false. And whether or not you agree with his policy outcomes or his policy positions, I think that's a larger issue that needs to be discussed and kind of flushed out.
Let me challenge you to answer one aspect of that. I think most people would broadly agree with that. But is there not a humanitarian crisis, Nick, with the number of asylum seekers coming in and kind of overwhelming the relevant kind of immigration judges and courts and detention facilities down
there?
Well,
it's partly because we're keeping everybody in detention facilities rather than doing what we had normally done. And actually, we're already dealing with that because some of the people are staying in Mexico while they wait for their asylum cases to be tried, or they're in American detention centers. But you know, it's, you know, to call that a national state of emergency, which somehow then implies building a wall in the middle of nowhere where asylum seekers are not even coming, because the whole point is they have to surrender to authorities in order to start their thing. We're talking about thousands of people. We're not talking about hundreds of thousands. We're not talking about, you know, millions of people swarming like a refugee camp. It means changing, you know, the processes in place. And either letting them enter the United States with ankle bracelets or other tracking devices. All previous cases, all studies of looking at asylum seekers who traditionally had been, while their cases were being settled, they were allowed to be in the United States and kind of move around in as long as they checked in with various caseworkers, or they had either institutions, foundations, or family members who would keep track of them. The compliance rates of showing up in court dates was, you know, anywhere between like 85% and 99%. This is not a crisis. It's an administrative problem. But it's not, you know, this is not, you know, a refugee camp with millions of people starving to death. This is not Bangladesh after some kind of typhoon or something like that. And I think that's really important. And it's also really important that Trump talks about the security aspect of all this all the time. And that's just total horseshit. There is no terrorist threat of people coming up from the southern border. At least there hasn't been historically. When he talks about the drugs flowing into the border, overwhelmingly, the DEA says, you know, that only a minimal amount, a very small percentage, and they don't name the percentage in their drug threat assessment, but they say a very small percentage comes in places that aren't ports of entry or actual checkpoints. So, you know, that, I mean, I think it's really important to stress all of this. And the other thing is that, you know, we can deal with that without declaring a national emergency, which then means building a slatted steel fence in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, Trump's spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, went on television and tried to say that there were 4,000 people who were, you know, on the terrorist watch list coming over the border. It turns out the actual answer is 6. And that terrorist watch list isn't a list of actual known terrorists. It's people who kind of maybe we think might be
people we're just watching.
Potentially, like, I mean, again, it's not, it's probably many of the people on that list are probably dangerous folks. But again, we're talking about 6 of them. And the administration was, you know, was out in the public trying to say that it was 4,000, wildly, wildly inflating these statistics. There's just not an emergency to speak of. And even if there was an emergency of the kind that you brought up, Matt, you know, sort of at the detention centers, the wall isn't going to solve that. That problem isn't fixed by building a wall that will take years and years, even if we get it built, even if the courts okay it through Trump's national emergency declaration, which, you know, will certainly be fought out in court over a year or two if he makes it. Like an immediate emergency would not be solved by a very long-term construction project.
I think it's also really important too, because, you know, our job here isn't to either defend or you know, oppose Donald Trump per se. When you look at the larger context, I mean, this battle, and it has to do with the government shutdown as well, is that you see Nancy Pelosi, you know, first off, you know, people like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who I wrote about recently, who are pro-wall and saying, you know, the wall's got to be built before the shutdown can end, or it's got to be okayed. I mean, in December, they went along with a Senate bill, a short-term spending bill that did not include funding for the wall. Now they have flipped 180 degrees. They're complete like liars about this, or not liars, but they're just, you know, they're totally weather vanes on this. But Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are also like this. And this isn't whataboutism when you're pointing out that both sides are absolutely full of shit on the topic at hand. Each of them within recent memory has supported building barriers on the wall, you know, on the border, and et cetera. All of these people are into a version of border security, which I think is overwrought to begin with. But you know, this is the teachable moment, and it is one of the reasons why the government is shut down and why it's the longest shutdown ever, is that both sides are dealing in such carefully manicured versions of the truth. Both are like rawly political about this kind of stuff. And it harkens back to when Mitch McConnell said, you know, our job is to make Barack Obama one-term president. People were aghast at that, not necessarily because he thought it, but he said it out loud and then kind of acted that way. And you know, this is a portrait of a dysfunctional government, which on a certain level, libertarians can hail and say, well, this is what it ends up as. But it doesn't have to. And as Thomas Massey has pointed out, you know, 2/3 of the budget is on autopilot. And the biggest spending stuff is going on as the government is dysfunctional, as the government is shut down. And, you know, we need to be forcing a conversation about what is wrong with the system to a point where, you know, obviously they can't pass budgets. If they can't pass budgets, they certainly can't, you know, change policy in a positive way or cut spending in the way that we need to if we want to have any kind of sustainable future.
Catherine, when you were watching the president's weird primetime speech last week, in which he was talking about, you know, the we could save, we could pay for this in part by saving money from all the heroin deaths that we're going to prevent as part of this. There are so many interesting arguments here. But did your heart start beating a little bit faster thinking, hey, we can actually use this as a teachable moment about prohibition of both drugs and of an immigration the flow of human labor?
I'm touched that you think I have a heart.
Yeah, you know, it's a theoretical.
No, neither my actual nor my theoretical heart started beating faster. If anything, I was filled with despair, because that is the exact kind of factoid. And it is a factoid in the real sense, which is a fact that is not exactly totally true that people repeat. It has the shape of a fact. It is something that people repeat because it sounds compelling, not because it's actually true. You know, that the president saying that number, which is an easily digestible number that people will remember on national television, is, I think, ultimately bad for our cause. It is bad for the cause of helping people have a more sophisticated understanding of where death tolls come from when we're talking about drugs. You know, there's the additional problem that you know, fentanyl actually comes from China by and large, that the fentanyl is largely responsible for deaths that are thought of as heroin deaths. Also, that when drugs are found coming across the border, they are typically at ports of entry. Like, there's a bunch of sort of subtle things that were wrong in that number that was good opportunity to point out. But I think the damage of having that 300 number said and repeated over and over and over on cable news, which it was that night and the next morning, in comparison to the teachable moment, you know, I think actually quite a lot of damage was done. This is, as I've said before, if ever there is a Mangue Ward's Law, and there won't be because my name is just a garbage fire, but if ever there is a Mangue Ward's Law, it will be laws put in place for national security will, within a very short period, be used to wage the war on drugs. and this is a sort of great example of that feedback loop occurring. There are terrorists, but also they bring the drugs. And anyway, the drugs kill Americans. So we could save money. So it's also a fiscal issue. The end, I get to do everything I want.
I would add,
my heart did not beat.
If there's a Welch law, maybe it'd be even a corollary, is that every measure taken to restrict the actions and behavior of illegal immigrants will always end up restricting the freedom of American citizens as well.
Yes. Also a good law. I think you have a better chance at having a law. So let's go with that one.
Suderman, speaking of drug and immigration nexus and also of Nick's kind of raw politics of this, I don't think I've seen, I think every single living libertarian and ex-libertarian has pounced on Mark Meadows' tweet. I think it was on Friday or Saturday. Mark Meadows, the congressman and chairman of the Freedom Caucus, coming out in favor of, you know, if as a last resort, we should maybe think about using asset forfeiture money to pay for the wall here. And I think Ted Cruz also has an El Chapo.
Yeah, the El Chapo Act, using any money that comes out of squeezing El Chapo and other drug lords would go. It is
that
an acronym,
by the way? I hope it's an acronym.
I have a piece up at Reason.com that includes the video, which also has like really cheesy little graphics where he's doing a winky dink thing where he's like, and so we need a wall. And he lifts his fingers and draws a wall and a wall appears. It's pretty incredible.
I just want to tell you, it's the ensuring lawful collection of hidden assets to provide order.
He's very proud of himself with that. And it's also
Chapo.
Peak Ted, you know, where he is playing Wolverine's father in the latest Logan movie, where he's
kind of like Wolverine's like second cousin.
Okay, he's like the Scooby Dumb to Scooby Doo of Wolverine. Let's put it at that.
Suderman, I remember correctly when the Tea Party first started, it was about the phrase "to provide order," right? That was kind of what they're into.
Taxed enough already.
Is this the moment that that the Freedom Caucus died, or are they always dead to you, Suderman?
Get your government hands off my Medicare. That was stuff that was said at like Tea Party rallies.
Wasn't that apocryphal?
Like,
there was one real sign. There was a real sign.
Yeah, but that sort of sentiment, the Tea Party, I think, you know, sort of there were some bright spots there, but a lot of it was really just, you know, we've talked about this before. It was what Thomas Massie said. They were not actually interested in any kind of particular ideology or set of policy ideas. They were just interested in the craziest sons of bitches in the room. And it turned out that the Tea Party types were best in class. Donald Trump now is. And so now the kind of the Freedom Caucus, which had been the kind of the locus of Tea Party activity in the Republican House, now the Freedom Caucus supports Trump because that's where their voters are, too. And Trump is not somebody who is I think it's fair to say, who really deeply believes in limited government ideology in any way. And so that means that the Freedom Caucus ends up not supporting that stuff. And I mean, it's really pretty telling. It's not just that Meadows said, well, you know, we should use asset forfeiture money, which is frequently ill-gotten and is just a really dubious practice. It's not just that he said, well, we probably need a national emergency if Democrats won't negotiate. It's that when questioned about this, he said, well, you know, sort of, I guess maybe I'm kind of uncomfortable, but Trump would find broad support if it's determined that he ultimately has to do it. That's not a principle of limited government. A bunch of Trump's backers would think this is great is not a system for thinking about what the government's role in the country is. It's just a kind of a populist refusal to limit government. And basically it's an admission that, like, if Trump's backers think this is a great idea and Trump wants to do it, you know what? I'm going to support it. I have no actual
I think it's really important to kind of situate all of this conversation. And I think Peter's totally right that, you know, what this reveals is that the Freedom Caucus and the Republican Party more broadly is not at all interested in limited government. They're interested in directed government as long as they get to direct where the money goes. I think it's really important to situate this in a 21st century context of this starts with George Bush. And it's really important to understand that because he was elected as a conservative, as somebody who was going to cut the size, scope and spending of government. And even before 9/11 was doing the exact opposite of that and then proceeded to blow out the budget in a way that hadn't been seen since LBJ. And he made a complete joke, and the Republican Party made a complete joke of its rhetorical deference to cutting government and to stopping spending and things like that. And that created, and I know Peter has written about this, and I think he's absolutely right, that gave an opening to Democrats to be like, fuck it, we're not even going to pretend to pay for stuff anymore. And to her credit, when Nancy Pelosi first became Speaker of the House back during the Bush years, she actually made, you know, she ran on promises of fiscal, continence, and she's still getting shit.
As did Barack Obama.
Yeah, he campaigned on a year-over-year spending cut. Pelosi is still getting shit for at least acknowledging the idea of PAYGO, the idea that any new government spending has to be offset with different, you know, with cuts from the left. But we are now in an era where...
Or with tax hikes.
Thank you. We are now in an era where both major parties who are, you know, absolutely in charge, but actually have fewer and fewer people who want to identify with them, are absolutely committed to just spending whatever the fuck they want without even pretending that you've got to pay for this. And this is not, it is not a partisan problem anymore. I don't know exactly how we get out of it, but it is them who just want to keep spending on whatever they consider really important and special and borrowing to do it versus the rest of us who are like, you know, at some point we're $22 trillion in debt. We have a massive ton of welfare programs, of wealth transfer programs, of law enforcement programs, of defense programs, of income stability programs and things like that. And we cannot afford this. I mean, it is killing economic growth. It is killing independent America. It's killing independent George. Like, we need to reel this in. And that's the real argument. And I think libertarians need to start finding, you know, the few people left scattered among, you know, Republican people and conservatives and also leftists who understand that, like, there is no free lunch. Like, at some point, you really do have to limit what you want to spend money on, partly because you can't afford it and partly you can't be effective if you're doing everything at once.
Speaking of anti-austerity commentators, although we weren't, Paul Krugman, the economist for the New York Times, who hates PAYGO and now really likes minimum wage increases, which is a marked difference to his previous commentary. He came out with a column, I think on Friday, saying that the government shutdown is a libertarian dream come true, a libertarian artifact or good for libertarians or something along those lines. Peter Suderman, you didn't agree with him. What's Paul Krugman getting wrong about our beautiful Somalia that we're enjoying right now?
Peter Suderman disagrees with Paul Krugman. Details at 11.
That's like 12 hours from now. We're going to get the details now.
Okay.
I thought the column, the idea that this form of that this particular shutdown is a great big libertarian experiment, which is basically what Krugman said, is, I think, just a real misunderstanding of what libertarians want and how libertarians think about the size of government issues. For one thing, it doesn't affect any of the mandatory spending, right? So the shutdown is a partial shutdown, which means that all of the biggest programs, Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, the parts of the government that are driving the long-term debt and deficits and that Congress really is barely touching because they're on autopilot, all those parts continue. That's not really a libertarian experiment in limited government. This is a temporary shutdown, right? So presuming that the government reopens, which I think is a pretty good assumption, that at some point all the federal workers here will go back to work and the government will resume normal functions. When that happens, The government will be just as big as it was before. And in fact, it will be a little bit larger because we'll be paying interest on all of the unpaid contracts that we weren't paying. In addition, we're not saving any money during this time because once the government reopens, the federal workers will get repaid. There's already a bill that's gone through the Senate that's it looks like Trump's going to sign to back pay these workers in basically every other similar circumstance of a government shutdown like this. The workers get back pay. So it doesn't save money. It's temporary. It doesn't actually touch the really big programs, the entitlements that are the drivers of our big fiscal problems. And in addition, it's sudden and unplanned. And I think this is a really big thing that we need to talk about is that libertarians aren't just like, well, let's just close it all. Let's kind of randomly close down a bunch of stuff tomorrow. What we would like to see is a government that functions better, that like a planned transition into a smaller government that is lasting and durable. And you don't get that by just kind of by having Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump get into a spat over our broken budget system about a border wall that no libertarian wants. That's just not a liberal. Fine that Catherine's giving me the maybe some libertarians want. That is really hard to justify, I think, on libertarian grounds, if
Let's
you ask
go with that.
Me.
Yep.
And or anyone on this podcast. Like, it's just that's not the libertarian idea of small government at all.
Catherine, do you associate yourself with that? A very Jeff Myron-esque. I can't ever ask you to disagree with Jeff Myron, I realize, who wrote a piece in Vox that was pretty similar to that, making the point that that libertarians recognize that they're outnumbered and they have to persuade people about stuff rather than try to necessarily force certain issues down. But is there some value in a demonstration project that life goes on?
There is some value. This is actually Reason's publisher, Mike Alisi, is probably the most pro-shutdown person on our staff because he has just that little bit of let the world burn that many good libertarians do have. And I think, you know, for instance, this weekend, the Libertarian Party went out and tried to clean up some of the trash, which has been infamously accumulating in the national parks during the shutdown. Apparently, they were told to go away, which is like metaphors within metaphors. Of course, it is true that the world didn't grind to a halt. We didn't all implode in the absence of government performing certain functions is useful. But in fact, people are loss averse and risk averse, so they tend to focus on the negatives. Also, there's a bunch of stuff that even pretty libertarian libertarians would like to see government doing that it's not currently doing, including things like sending through approvals on new aircraft or investigating identity fraud filings. I mean, there's some very basic law enforcement stuff that is on hold right now. So, yes, as always, I associate myself with Jeff Myron. I also wanted to talk about the other Paul Krugman column that I thought you were going to raise, which is his All the Economists Agree a 70% top marginal tax rate is fine column, which, you know, he's really been trying to trigger libertarians.
Can I just say, the government shutdown, though, is worth defending from a libertarian perspective. Peter is right. Doing this kind of half-assed thing, without an end in sight where it's provisional, none of this is, what libertarians, think of in the first order. But there are tons of places here where we can really start to rethink things. TSA is a great example where, TSA people are calling in sick, they're understaffed, all of this kind of stuff. This is a perfect case where the private sector, meaning the airlines, who should also be running the airports, which they're not currently, they should be providing airport security and airline security subject to federal oversight. This is how it's done in Europe. It's how it's done in Canada. And it works really well. And one of the great things it does is it takes a basic everyday functioning that works really well in markets, and it takes it out of needing government control. There's so many, other examples of things like that, where we should be shifting as much out of political control as possible, precisely because politics gets sticky all the time, and it's inefficient to begin with. It's ineffective many of the times. And here are ways where we just don't have to deal with this, because it's fascinating to me that this time the government shutdown, and the last time in 2013 was like, oh my God, the services that are provided are so incredibly important that, you know, the world is just going to fall apart because a bunch of military bands won't be able to travel anymore. And stuff like that. Now it's all about how, oh, these workers aren't going to get paychecks. And it's like, it really is awful. You know, it sucks for them and everything. But, you know, government isn't a jobs program. Government is not a jobs program. It's not fundamentally about that. It's about providing certain basic services and a framework for the rest of us to get on with our lives. And one of the major libertarian points is that government should be doing less, because that way people can get on with their lives regardless of circumstances beyond their control.
Nick, I agree that the TSA is not a great way to provide for airport security, but a shutdown like this, where you don't know when it's coming, you don't know how long it's going to be, makes it very hard for a replacement service, a private system to come up in its place. And so in the end, we're left with an even worse version of the TSA, which is already a not great way of providing for security at airports.
The TSA is bullshit, and we all know that. And all I'm saying is, it's like, you know, let's own certain parts of this, where it's like, TSA is security theater. Republicans who created the TSA, who signed off on it in a big way 10 years after its creation, you know, agreed with that. It's security theater. It is bullshit. It doesn't work. Let's build off of that. Again, not to demonize particular people or anything, but we want secure airlines, right? We want secure air flights. We want secure airspace and all of that. There are ways to do that that take the government out of the equation, so that we don't have to worry about this in the possibility of other shutdowns or just political upheavals. There are other places where we can be doing that.
Just, I love it that there was actually a little miniature TSA scandal this weekend. They let a gun through. In a move that I actually give them credit for, they didn't blame the shutdown. They were just like, yeah, we're not that good at catching stuff.
One of my new favorite shutdown era Twitter memes is of, responsible Washington or New York, Acela Corridor journalists saying, you know, I just got through Reagan National with all the TSA people, and they were super friendly, and they were very professional, and they didn't complain once about missing a paycheck. And we're supposed to say, oh, surprise.
I know we're all deaf to virtue signaling now. We've all built up our virtue signaling immunity, but that particular maneuver that's like, I have interacted with the common man and he is indeed noble, makes me want to die.
Speaking of wanting to die.
good segue for everything.
Good segue. There's a new candidate declared for the 2020 presidential, Democratic presidential nomination scrum here. Tulsi Gabbard. And I'm sure I'm mispronouncing every bit of her name, the very unusual Democratic Congresswoman Hawaii, who is a former National Guard vet, strong anti-interventionist, a Hindu-American, whatever that means, because that has a lot of different meanings, actually. I have found it to be unusual and perhaps instructive to see what a lot of the kind of never Trump center right has been reacting towards her, which is, to kind of sum it up in a word, is that, oh, we got another Putin stooge on our hands here, which is kind of amazing. She has an unusual background. As I mentioned, she famously went to Syria and met bizarrely with Bashar al-Assad to talk about the goings-on there, and had held press conferences. Strange and odd behavior out there. But here's the thing that worries me. In the context where we have, you know, a Max Boot column over the weekend saying like the 18 ways that Trump is acting as if he might as well be a Vladimir Putin stooge, And I say this as the person who hates Russia more than life itself. And I tend to think that there's a lot there in the Russian investigation of Trump. But it feels like we're getting off the rails here of like where every single that person who comes in with a pretty strongly anti-interventionist point of view is immediately seen in a paranoiac way as a Russian stooge. Nick, how much do you agree with me?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tulsi Gabbard is fascinating because she's being attacked by both the, you know, certain aspects of the right, but especially the left, because she doesn't fit into a conventional either, you know, centrist, liberal, progressive Democrat or, you know, kind of right wing perspective. She talked with Donald Trump about a possible position in his administration, which, you know, goes to show how far she ranges. Her economics are terrible. I mean, she's basically part of the, you know, Medicare, et cetera, for all. She has some odd kind of very socially conservative predilections in her recent past, which she's already trying to throw overboard. I think what's most interesting about her is just that she presents some, you know, she is the new kind of version. We're going to be seeing more and more of this of politicians who don't fit into existing categories because the existing categories don't really make sense anymore. Having said that, specifically to your point, the idea that Trump is, you know, is so pro-Russia that it's obvious that he's an asset. You know, I'm curious about, like, other than the rhetorical stuff and saying, hey, you know what, let's let Russia and Syria and India and Turkey, you know, and Iran, like, kill each other in Syria. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Trump has actually levied various forms of sanctions, or the Trump administration and the government, against various types of kleptocrats over there. He's pushed back on other things. So it's, you know, I don't think it's a... I think it's a losing strategy ultimately in American politics to say anybody who is not perceiving Russia as the most immediate threat to everything that's good and decent in America is a Russian asset. That's kind of a dead end.
I actually think her, you sort of mentioned some social conservatism in her recent past. I actually think we should talk about that for a quick second, yeah, if y'all don't mind, because it's pretty interesting, and it's definitely not in her recent past. Her father is basically an anti-gay activist.
I don't think he is any longer.
Ran the Alliance for Traditional Marriage, which was a PAC, basically.
Yeah, and Hawaii was an early battleground over whether or not gay marriage was going to be legalized at a time when, you know, or civil unions at a time when nobody in the country was talking about
it. So she worked for her dad when she was 17 and then said nice things about that experience when she was 21. She has since, as far as I can tell, 100% flipped and supported the abolition of the Defense of Marriage Act, the repeal of DOMA, all that kind of stuff.
I believe, though, that she's also, she has still said, or I saw in an interview that was done with her somewhat in the near recent past, that she is personally opposed to abortion, but, you know, I guess is not against it. In the Democratic Party, that's kind of apostasy.
I guess the thing that's interesting to me, though, is in a time when we are canceling people's, you know, comedy gigs for a tweet from 7 years ago, you know, how are we going to handle someone who has changed her mind in the public eye on a pretty big issue?
You mean like President Obama?
Right. So this is what I was going to say is like, I'm seeing an awful lot of, and maybe this is just the Twitter and the you know, social media that I'm on, but I'm seeing an awful lot of some dumb stuff she said about her dad's organization when she was 17 is an absolute killer, and there's no way we can allow her to ever rise in the ranks of federal power. But I'm not seeing a lot of like, well, she changed her mind and now she's right, it's all good. I wonder if we would or will see that. Again, she's kind of a category breaker in a bunch of ways. So I'm not sure she has a constituency that propels her forward.
It's interesting. But, go ahead.
I think that she is, you know, people are lining her up, you know, and Julian Castro also announced for president. And I guess Elizabeth Warren more or less has. But I think People, particularly on the progressive left, there's a long piece in Jacobin magazine kind of attacking her, also for various kind words or alliances she has with Modi in India, who is a bad actor for various reasons. But I think they're looking to kind of nip potential challengers to people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and candidates who have been vetted more fully in the bud. So there's a kind of throw everything against
Suderman,
the wall against
I know
people
that
like
you
her.
Spent some time recently with a bunch of national security types, and I'm not asking you to completely throw your entire family under the bus, but is your impression, give us the temperature of the kind of Trump Russia panic from what you might have recently witnessed?
So, I mean, I just, without getting into too many details, I think I can say that if you talk to folks in the intelligence community, folks who have sort of worked in the Foreign Service, diplomatic corps, that part of Washington, there is not quite near unanimous, but there's a very strong suspicion, strongly held belief that Donald Trump is some sort of Russian agent or is compromised by Russia somehow or another. And when you know, it's a lot like some of the sort of never Trump most, the most hawkish kinds of worried that Trump it's and I should even say it's more kind of center left than it is center right. And it kind of represents a certain sort of there's a certain sort of beltway consensus. We've talked about this a little bit before on the podcast, but the beltway, the kind of inner Washington foreign policy world, and that goes for the kind of intelligence and security community, as well as all the diplomatic people and just sort of the foreign policy studies folks, is just kind of reflexively hawkish. There is not a really big power base that isn't super hawkish. And they're quite suspicious of people like Trump. And I frankly am not. I am probably the most open to the idea that Trump is somehow possibly compromised by Russia somehow or another, or at least that his business dealings have created a kind of implicit compromise, although I am not in any way convinced of this. I think it's at least a possibility. But even still, there's a kind of certainty about this stuff within the foreign policy community in Washington. That is really kind of interesting to see. And it's especially interesting in that there is just not a huge amount of pushback. There's not a sort of center of sane non-interventionism that is skeptical of this stuff. And I think it's a real failing of kind of beltway policymaking and of the beltway policy elite that there doesn't exist another side to this, and it's really hard to find kind of folks and ideas that are well worn, that have been sort of put through the ringer, that we should take, that aren't kind of in some sense a little bit fringy. There are some places that try to do this. I mean, certainly we try at Reason and the Cato Institute tries some of this, but there isn't a big power center of non-interventionism in Washington that is that takes a skeptical eye to this stuff and that is willing to sort of be a little bit more reticent about America's place in the world and also about how we think about Donald Trump and his particular
issues. I wrote a couple of weeks back about some of the criticism of Green Party candidate Jill Stein, which contains a lot of overlap with the kind of Max Boot analysis of Donald Trump, which is to say the people saying, hey, look at her policies. She's opposed to NATO expansion. And she's, and she's anti, she likes these things that she, like Vladimir Putin, doesn't want to intervene into Syria. And there's this real, I think, danger in conflating all of those policy preferences with being kind of automatically pro whoever your adversary is. But in this case, it's really Vladimir Putin. And,
come on. I mean, our foreign policy has been a total clusterfuck. At least, and let's be, just a kind of boundary the argument in the 21st century. like, we need a change. And then if people like Gabbard is going to be, you know, or Rand Paul for that matter, or anybody who challenges the existing kind of predilections is going to be, you know, run out of decent conversation, things are never going to change. I mean, and you got to give Donald Trump credit for this. I mean, he got Noam Chomsky to support U.S. military intervention abroad in Syria. You know, so it's like something is happening here, right, where the old categories do not apply. They shouldn't apply. They have been shown to be a failure. We have shitty economic growth. We have a disastrous foreign policy that isn't making us safer and that is destroying large parts of the world. Something has to change. And I think Gabbard is, what's interesting about her is less her specifically. And it's that we're going to start seeing more and more people like this coming in, and we're going to see a different consensus kind of emerge. And it might not be one that's friendly to libertarianism, but it's happening and it needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah. Nick, do you worry that the new categories will actually be worse? Because frankly, I worry about this, that it's just going to be socialists, that it's going to be big government socialists versus basically big government populists rather than sort of nominally limited government Republicans. And I say nominally because they're not really limited government, who have bad ideas about foreign policy versus Democrats who have some better ideas about social policy and bad ideas about economics. I mean, like, I worry that that we will end up with a new binary that will be even worse than the old binary.
Well, this is, this is the challenge, you know, that Hayek threw down and a bunch of other people, is that, like, you know, for every generation, you have to you have to kind of renew you take basic principles and then renew them for the circumstances you're in. And it's clear the post-war consensus is ending. And the post-war consensus very much had a foreign policy component that was central to it. And it was that America is the indispensable nation and that we have to project military force everywhere and we have to be in every region. That, you know, that is not working for us anymore, nor should it. And there are lots of reasons why we shouldn't be projecting military force as opposed to economic or cultural force, which Trump is problematic on. But I think, you know, there is a coming difference in what is the point of government. Peter, you said yesterday or last week, you were talking about how certain conservatives, and this bubbled up in Tucker Carlson's monologue, they're now saying that the role of government is to make people happy, to secure people's happiness as opposed to the pursuit of happiness. That's a huge shift. I think there's a lot of that on the progressive left, and that's one side of an argument. And libertarians need to be, you know, making an interesting and persuasive and compelling case and finding new allies that are left behind from those other groups as they move in that direction to say, no, you know what, actually limited government and individual freedom to build the world you want to live in and be flexible in and have a government that isn't going to completely suck up all of the economic energy, all of the money, all of the ability to move. This is the world we want. We want a more libertarian world.
Speaking of the pursuit of happiness, Catherine, take us away from politics and tell us what marvelous things you have been consuming in your spare time.
I have been consuming the entire world in slightly better focus because I just got my new glasses.
Wow.
So I had LASIK in 2002. My eyeballs maybe-ish stopped working a little bit, which I noticed when I failed the eye exam for my driver's license. And so I got some new glasses. I got them from Warby Parker. I basically just want to take a minute to do like a capitalism kind of situation here.
Saved your eyes again.
Capitalism saved my eyes again. And it's just awesome, man. Like, I had glasses as a kid. I remember them being a huge, like, financial burden on my family. I remember them all being sort of confusing and ugly in direct relationship to their price. And that's all over now. And it's because, like, all these cartels got busted, innovative models for how the industry works. I paid $95. I got a cool pair of glasses that the marketing people at Warby Parker assure me are cool, and that's all I want.
That now she can look over and judge you.
And I am going to judge the bejesus out of everyone by looking at them over my glasses. So everyone, get ready for even more judgmental, Catherine.
The entire Reason Office is about to be judged.
Are you doing
so
the Chuck
hard.
Schumer already?
Yes, I am fully Chuck Schumering everyone right now. So just imagine me henceforth judging you over the top of my miraculous capitalism.
Speaking
glasses.
Of Chuck Schumering, Peter, what kind of porn are you watching?
I've been watching the first season of Better Call Saul, which is the prequel follow-up to Breaking Bad, and it's pretty great. I know I'm a couple of years late to this, but it's really delightful. Really, like, just kind of smartly written drama about a guy who wants to be good and just can't seem to do it.
Nick?
I'm reading another Raymond Chandler novel, Farewell, My Lovely, which is an earlier work than The Long Goodbye. And it's a fascinating L.A. noir set in, published in 1940. And it's good, but not as good as The Long Goodbye.
Farewell, My Lovely, I think is the first and The Long Goodbye is the last, right, of the Marlowe novels?
It's not quite, but Farewell, My Lovely is the second or third, I think. And The Long Goodbye is either the last or second to last. But you can see, by the way, one of the things that's fascinating about the book is that there's a lot of racial stereotypes in it. And it's hard to know when you're reading it, because this, you know, is a live question of, like, what do you do with art from the relatively recent past? And this is 70, 80 years old, that traffics in stereotypes that are now, you know, just not allowable in public, you know, in civilized conversation and whatnot. One of the things that's interesting about it is that it's not clear. It's kind of like in something like Huckleberry Finn, where Chandler's position and perspective on this is odd, because at various points he seems to be critiquing the casual racism and sexism of the day. And at other moments he is participating in it. But this reminds me of an interesting story that is coming out in Arlington, Virginia, where one of the high schools, which has been called Washington and Lee, is working to change its name. And originally they were going to change it to Washington and Loving to commemorate the Lee was Robert E. Lee. They were going to change it to commemorate the couple in Loving versus Virginia, which was the Supreme Court case which struck down bans on interracial marriages. And now it looks like it's going to be Washington Liberty. But, you know, I'm fascinated by these questions that come out of, what do you do with a past that is just, insufferable in the current moment? And how do you engage it, or do you ignore it? Do you, do you just drop things that are problematic in that sense?
I consumed over the weekend the exact same thing that everybody who spent any time over the weekend on social media consumed, which was the single greatest gymnastics floor exercise.
Oh my God! It's
in
so
the
good.
History of humankind, by Caitlin Ohashi from UCLA. I got a 10, and I think the go-to description is like 10's just not enough for this, and it kind of isn't. It managed to be it's more of a dance a routine as much as anything else, but also the most badass gymnastics you've ever seen. And just trolling around a little bit, and there's interesting follow-up reporting on her as a person. She'd broken part of her back not terribly long ago, and has said things to the effect that it was only by kind of giving up a long-term trying to be the top world gymnast that she discovered that to actually have fun. She expresses a kind of fun and joy of being essentially on a dance floor that you almost never see in gymnastics and figure skating, where all the dance elements are weird, perfunctory, this is what princesses are supposed to do to show that they're not just like brute athletes kind of thing. And instead, it's just this marvelous expression of athleticism and joy. And it's great.
Although, Matt, I got to ask, do you believe ever those like human interest segments on the sports?
They're all lies. They're all lies.
Media. Like, I always feel like every single person like broke their back, had asthma, was raised poor, and have miraculously overcome it to have
Catherine,
joy in their
this
sport.
Is why, like, isn't that... This is why you, like the Tin Man, needs to go to Oz and get a heart, because the human drama
got her bullshit detector on, Matt. Come on.
Is a beautiful
I have a bullshit
thing.
Detector where my heart should be is a thing that I would like you to put on my gravestone.
And that's all the time we have left for the recent podcast. Go subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, rate and review us, and stay tuned on that channel for more exciting reasoned content. Goodbye.